The Supreme Court of Texas is now in session pursuant to adjournment.
Please be seated. Part of the event, like this. Argument from petition.
May it please the court, Your Honor, this is a fairly simple fact case in that it is initiated as a collection suit on a petitioner where respondent Bob Carroll Construction Company performed various tasks, oil field services for the petitioner C.L. Tyron, and in performing these tasks, it finally came, these were done on an open account with there was no interest agreed on at the time that the work was done. The respondent Bob Carroll Construction Company filed an original petition in approximately 1978, where in their original petition they asked for 1.5% interest payable within 30 days after the time that the statements were filed. The petition was a sworn account. It was sworn to under oath by the comptroller for Bob Carroll Construction Company, the respondent, and the attorney for the respondent had also executed that original petition. Pursuant to the original petition, the petitioner in this case, C.L. Tyra, answered and then filed a counterclaim based on usury against the Bob Carroll Construction Company for usury. The respondent then amended his petition, eliminating any usurious claims, claiming that they were all placed in the original petition by error. At the trial, the C.L. Tyra entered in the evidence, the original petition, as evidence, and the respondent, Bob Carroll Construction Company, then offered into evidence various letters, collection letters, and ledgers, and other items showing that they had never charged interest before the date of the original petition, and that the placing of the usurious interest in the original petition was in error. The trial court held for the respondent, Bob Carroll Construction Company, saying that there was no usurious interest as charged and that there was bona fide error. Subsequently, no finding of facts was entered into, was asked for, and upon a request for new trial, the trial court rejected that request, and the C.L. Tyra appealed to the Court of Appeals based on three points of error. That is, the first one being whether or not there was a charge of interest, the second whether or not there was bona fide error on the part of the respondent, and the third being an issue as to damages under 5069-106 dealing with double amount of interest and forfeiture of the principal amount. The Court of Appeals reversed or did not grant the first point of error, that is, as to the charge, and said that the second and third points of error were moot. The petitioner then, C.L. Tyra, asked for a motion for a new hearing based on the original first point, and the court denied that. And pursuant to that, then C.L. Tyra then asked for a writ of error to your court based on the first point of error as to the charge.
I'm sorry, I didn't follow you on this last paragraph with you.
Okay, what it is...
A tip of the mootness question. I didn't know that was in the case.
Yes, sir. What the court said was we initially had 3 points of error.
What court?
The Court of Appeals in El Paso. There were 3 points of... After the 3 points of error. One, that if there was a charge of interest. Two, that there was no bona fide error and three, the issue as to damages. And the Court of Appeals said that since they answered that there was no charge of interest, it was moot to ask to answer the question as to bona fide errors.
And unnecessary.
It was unnecessary.
Yes. But maybe somebody's got a settlement in on this matter.
No. And therefore, we ask for a writ of error based on the first point of error, that is, whether or not there was a charge to the Supreme Court of Texas. Getting past the fact issue, the only thing we're talking about here is whether or not there was a charge of interest. The first thing we have to do is look at this statute and say, first of all, was there usurious interest charged? And I don't think there's any doubt there because it was an open account. And Article 5069-103 says that if you have an open account, the maximum amount of interest you can charge is 6% per annum. And here the plaintiff's original petition asked for 1.5% interest per month, 30 days after the statement was sent out. Based on that, then there is usurious interest. You have to go to Article 5069-106. And that statute says, in effect, that if any person who contracts for, charges, or receives interest which is greater than the amount authorized by this subtitle. Okay, the Supreme Court has said in their case, the Windhorse case, that that is a disjunctive. All you have to have is one of them, one of those, either a contract, a charge, or a receipt. Here, we are claiming that the original petition was a charge for interest. Falling under 106, we are basing it on whether or not there was a charge. The 5069-106 is a penal statute, and if it does apply, it does pertain to if there's an offense that there can be a fine, and this is part two of 5069-106, and it is penal in nature. Therefore, it must be construed strictly because it is penal, and the Court of Appeals in Pinemont, Vance versus Blue Cross, that did hold this, and that it is penal. Because it is to be strictly construed, the question is, do you need intent for this statute? The statute said any person who charges interest. It does not say any person who intends to charge interest that is usurious. Therefore, you get into a question, which I'll bring up later, was intent even necessary? Was it a pertinent part of the statute? I say it was not, and therefore all we're going to be looking at is the original petition and not the evidence that was submitted by Bob Carroll Construction Company during the trial. In looking at this question, you must look at, since the statute deals with charges, you look at the time that the charge was made, not what happened before the charge was made and not what happened after the time the charge was made. We'll get into in a few minutes about the Bob Carroll Construction Company did amend their petition. And it's going to be my contention that it makes no difference if there was a subsequent amended petition because you must look at that point in time whether or not there was a charge. And also later on we'll talk about the fact that the respondent, Bob Carroll Construction Company, brought up much evidence showing that he never intended to put in usurious interest in this petition. But I'm going to claim that's irrelevant in that you still must look at the statute and look at that time and place and say whether or not there was a charge of interest at that particular time. Okay. Then focusing on this, all we need is a charge. There is no intent. No intent is needed. The next item is, what is a charge? And the courts upheld that, and these are courts of appeal in Waco and Amarillo, they've held that all a charge is a demand. And it's my contention that the an original petition is an ultimate demand. If your original petition, if you're asking for an interest in it, I don't know what larger demand you could have besides putting a gun to someone's head. Therefore, I would say that there is a charge, no intent is needed, and there is demand. Therefore, based on the facts of this case, looking at it and seeing if there, we had an original petition, that original petition made a demand for 1.5% interest per month within 30 days, you'd have to say that there is a charge which would fall under 5069-106. And the fact then, subsequently, you run into the fact, well, there was an amended petition. Okay, what effect does this amended petition have on the original petition? It's my contention that even though they've amended the original petition, that doesn't throw it out the window. If you did that, then anyone could get out from the penalties that's provided under 5069-106. And you can't allow somebody to say, on the one hand, I'm charging you interest, and oops, I made a mistake, and I'm going to wipe it out and let's start all over. The respondent brings up and says, well, since it was amended, it no longer is a judicial admission. I'm willing to concede that. It's evidence. Let's just say it's evidence on this point, this original petition. But the type of evidence it is that it's a charge. And it's not like where you got a broken leg and you have to compile evidence on top of evidence. Here, all we have to do is show that there was a charge of interest. And the minute that that petition went on file and my client was served, there was a charge at one point in time. And no matter what happened afterwards, is irrelevant. There was a charge. Then at the trial, the respondent brought up much evidence showing, one, that all the collection letters did not have any usurious interest in it. That two, there was a ledger sheet that had no usurious interest, and that they had never authorized the attorney to put in any type of interest in the petition. But my contention is that this is irrelevant. All this goes to is intent, what they intended to do. It doesn't have anything to do with the point in fact that there was a charge the day that the CL tire was served with that petition, and there was a charge at that period of time. Therefore, I would have to say, and this is be bolstered by Southwest Investment versus Hockley, it was Court of Appeals case out of Amarillo that in effect said that later on came up to this court, and the court said no reversal error, that also said that you must look at the time of the inception or the time of the charging of the interest, and what happens around it makes no difference. And the Supreme Court in its case, although it didn't deal with the question of the intent, it did talk about the question of whether or not you could allow someone to come back and amend something after the fact to change what they'd already done. And the court said if you allowed someone to amend it, that would allow the lender or the creditor to circumvent the statute, and it would throw the statute out the window. Therefore, I would contend that under the facts of this case, there can be no type of question at all that there was interest charged, and there was no offsetting evidence to counterbalance this charge. The fact that there was a usurious charge in this petition also is bolstered by the case Nationwide versus Nationwide Financial Corporation versus Freddie E. English is from the Court of Appeals of Tyler, and a Court of Appeals case of Austin from Moore versus Sabine National Bank, which both of them held that pleadings were charges. And there again, that just bolsters my case in that when the...
Did they amend the pleadings in those cases?
In one of the cases they did, Your Honor, I believe, and in the other one they did not. I might be wrong, but I believe in one of them they did and one they didn't. So our point is, we feel our point is bolstered by these two cases. Thus, once I put on my argument that there was a charge, there's two aspects as to the respondents that have gone over that I'd like to cover preliminary before he does. And that is the issue as to the superseded pleading. Here again, I've already talked about this, but I'd just like to reiterate that the fact that there was a superseded pleading or an amended pleading that wiped out he said that the usurious interest was an error and I didn't mean to put it in, that still leaves the original petition as evidence. And here again, I don't feel there was any evidence to kind of balance this because the respondent offered no evidence except intent, what their intent was. The next issue is the fact that there were no finding of facts and conclusions of law. I can see that. There was no finding of facts and conclusions of law. However, even when the evidence is taken in a light most favorable to the respondent, that is the fact that you look at his evidence dealing with they didn't intend to put in this usurious interest, that they amended their petition, that there was a ledger that didn't show any usurious interest. It makes no difference because none of this evidence even went to the point, was there a charge, which is the crucial point here. And that's why even when you look at all the facts, you look at all the law in their favor, all the facts in their favor, all the evidence in their favor, there is nothing that is needed to support their position because it was all based on intent. The law was all based on one, was there a charge? We know that there was a charge. Next question, was there bona fide error, which is not before y'all, but is an issue before the Court of Appeals? You can't sustain it on that because there is no bona fide. There was no bona fide error. There could be no bona fide error because as a matter of law, you had someone that swore to the pleadings that they were true and correct. In the matter of interest, there's no question there as a matter of law that it was used. So,
Counsel, excuse me. Just trying to understand you. Did you say that the matter of bona fide error was not before?
No, sir, it is not before.
Why not?
Because at the time, and it's an error on my part, all I did was file the initial Court of Appeals when they said that there was no charge, so they did not rule on the part of bona fide error. And when I asked for a motion for rehearing, all I asked for was a rehearing on the point of charge and not bona fide error, and therefore I could not rule it.
So, I might have a procedural problem. If there are three bases for a judgment and you attack only two, as I understand it.
Well, I'm hoping what we can do here, Your Honor, is get a ruling that there was a charge and then remand it to the Court of Appeals for them to find on the point of bona fide error. Since it is before, it's still before them.
Did I understand you earlier, counsel, to say that the Court of Civil Appeals did not rule on bona fide error?
That's correct, Your
Honor. They found no charge. No, that's the only finding they had.
Yeah, the only finding they had is no charge and they never answered any more. They, in effect, said the other points were moot because they found no charge. Procedurally, well, you're going to have to find a charge
they
first.
They didn't hold against you on that.
Pardon?
Did they not
They did not hold against you on that.
On the bona fide oath?
Yeah.
That's right, Hunter. They made no ruling whatsoever. They just said it was unnecessary to even rule on that because the first point, whether or not there was a charge, they found against it. Therefore, in summary, we would like to just say that there was a charge. I don't think there's any evidence or anything to show that would contradict it. And therefore, we think as a matter of law, you have to find that there was a charge. And we ask that you do, in fact, reverse the Court of Appeals on this point of error and remand it back to them to rule on the bona fide error issue.
Thank you, counsel. The argument from the opponent.
This is a case involving whether or not there is a charge of interest. Before I go any farther, I've had a bad cough for 6 weeks, and I realize that these things are being recorded, and I don't have much of a voice because of the drainage I've had. Because of that, I prepared to talk only 15 to 17 minutes, and that is in keeping with my theory that the mind can only absorb what directs.
We can spend 30 minutes, then.
I'm just afraid that I may have to step away from this microphone very quickly, and it won't be any difference to the court. It's just that I don't want to cough into this thing that's being recorded.
Okay.
I agree that the question is, was there a charge of interest? And if so, if there is, quote, a charge of interest, what evidence would have supported that charge of evidence? Most of the fact situation has been presented to you by Tyra, and I will refer to the parties as C.L. Tyra and Bob Carroll Construction Company. The sole contention, as I understand it by them, is that the filing of that petition was a demand and a charge of interest. I'm going to differentiate some of the cases that he's just given to you and believe that I can do that for the court and be able to show how this is not an attempt to void the statute in any manner, shape, or form. It is an unusual case. If you look at the fact situation, I believe that you will find that to be the case. Tyra says that the charge of interest in the penalties invoked by Article 5069-106 is automatically invoked by the filing of that original petition. And that original petition, which has long been recognized through the Texas Supreme Court in Long v. Knox in 1956, specifically stated in an admission against interest in an abandoned pleading may be used in evidence against the pleader, but is not conclusive. In other words, you're going to be able to put on more evidence. Ray, on Texas Law of Evidence, in Section 1146, states, when a pleading is abandoned, superseded, or amended, it disappears from the record as a formal judicial admission and is, of course, no longer binding on the pleader in the sense that he is prevented from disputing the facts contained therein.
Counsel, let's assume that different people, different corporations, and we have an outfit that they're throwing this 1.5%, and they're dealing with people with small running and running tennis shoes, and they pay up. And then when somebody smart comes along, they accept it, and so the charge is just to, oh, excuse me, and that's all. Why isn't that a charge?
I would agree that that is a charge of interest. They actually charge it. They put it on their books. It is a charge. They're demanding it from those people. Those people pay up. I have no problem with that, and I would be the first one to say, whenever they go that far, and they put it in there, and they are expecting to collect it, and that is a part of their practice. Yes, sir, they have violated that statute, and that statute ought to apply to them.
So you're saying intent is controlling?
Intent is not controlling. That actually goes on their books. Whenever they put that in there, they are charging.
That's the part they don't put it on the books. They just demand it to court.
I would say if they go through and they admit in evidence that they are charging it, they put on evidence to the fact that we're entitled to 1.5% per month, 30 days after invoice, yes, sir, they have charged that kind of interest. What I'm saying is the Bob Carroll case differs, and I'll flip over. In this case, there were 8 invoices sent to Tyra. No interest was on the face of any of those invoices. That's in the transcript, pages 5 through 12, 48 through 46. It's in the statement of facts, page 13, lines 1 through 18. Secondly, the comptroller of accounts came up and testified that no interest was ever charged. Bob Carroll
did swear to the petition.
Yes, sir, he did. And I'll be able to differentiate that in these 6 points that I have set out for the court. He is the same one who signed that petition. It was explained from the witness stand that on the front page of the petition there was no demand for interest. You were able to look, see that it was the face value of the claim. And if you were familiar with the account and knew that there was no interest on it, you knew that that was there, he flipped over to the back and signed. And that was explained in into the record.
I'm signed by the things I haven't read. It's a foreign
case. I understand that, Your Honor, and I am saying that he was checking the face value of the amount, knew that there would not be any interest charged, and therefore was convinced whenever he saw it on the front of the invoices for the merchandise that he knew about that he signed it, and so stated. The unilateral charge of interest, there was no contract to charge it. And I, as the attorney of record, was not authorized, told, or in any manner supposed to put it in there. The same comptroller had written a demand letter to Tyra. Nowhere in that demand letter, which is in the statement of facts, page 5, was there any demand for interest. I wrote a demand letter in addition to his some months later that's in the transcript, page 81, the statement of facts, page 22. No demand of interest. I would have been demanding interest if it would have been available. I unfortunately also got to testify in this particular case. There was no interest charged on invoices. I had done work for this company before, knew that they had no contract to charge interest, and so testified. Interest was not supposed to be in there. I had sent that demand letter not asking for interest, and on top of that, I had to file the answer admitting the mistake made in my office. It was done through whenever it was brought in and had to be filed quickly, that I gave the secretary a name of a client that I knew would be a suit which should be similar to this, and unfortunately I gave her the name of one that does have a contract, one that can charge 1.5% for interest, complies with Regulation Z. My secretary typed that up, and I unfortunately made the same error as the comptroller. I read the front page, knew I had a very competent secretary, we have it on mag cards. I proceeded to sign that instrument. I'm not proud of that. I can look the court in the eye and say we have some safeguards that won't happen again. And that, unfortunately, is what happened in this case. There was no interest ever put on any of the ledger sheets. And as I say, the testimony from everyone, Bob Carroll does not charge interest on any account, has never charged interest on this account in any manner, shape, or form. The actual ledger sheet, is in the transcript on page 80. There is no interest noted on the date of the filing of that petition, before it, after it. It's not only not a case of not intending to charge interest, that company never charges interest on any account, and that is in the record. Now, Long versus Knox recognizes that when you abandon a pleading, someone can use it against you. But you've got to look at the evidence as a whole in this particular case. I think the evidence as a whole points out that this is a different situation than you have in the Moore versus the B National Bank case, which was cited from the Court of Appeals in Austin, refused no reversible error. There was a time differential charged anywhere from 25.68% to 128.59%. It was put in a written contract between the parties, similar to the debt situation that the court has asked me about, except they use the example of, well, they don't put it in a contract, and I'll get to that in a moment. They put it in their notice of repossession that they were charging for those items. They filed it in their original petition. They filed it in a sequestration affidavit setting forth demands for interest. No evidence was put on about the usurious interest except an attorney on the sequestration affidavit said he thought he had figured it wrong and then turned around and admitted that there was evidence, that the interest that was set forth in the contract was what was in the sequestration affidavit and the petition, which would admit that they were charging usurious interest. The Tower case, of course, there's no contract. evidence is no interest is charged on all the parties testifying. The plea was abandoned, and then the evidence came forth to support that no evidence is charged. In Nationwide Financial Corporation versus English, that's the pilot with no writ history. This is the case where there were time differentials in the contract. It was pled in the original petition. They admitted those charges in the interrogatory that they were charging what in effect was usurious interest, and then attempted to withdraw their pleading and say, whoops, we didn't mean it. They tried to amend it and drop it completely out from their pleading and thought that they could go to trial and just say, we didn't mean it. Specifically, I believe the question that the court asked earlier from Tyra. This is the case. In the Tyra case, there's no contract. That petition was abandoned as soon as it was brought to our attention for the reason that had this case have gone to trial, we would have had no evidence to charge any interest whatsoever. I knew that they didn't charge interest, and when I presented my case to the court, I could not have taken a judgment for any interest at 1.5% per month, 30 days from the date of the invoice. My comptroller could not have testified to it. I knew they didn't charge it. I unfortunately made a very terrible mistake. The pleadings were sworn to. It started off as an open account between the parties where they had charged back and forth. Pleadings were signed to by the comptroller swearing to this. I did sign them as the attorney for the petition, not swearing to it.
Did
the
account affect their invoice?
Yes, sir. I had copies of the invoices attached to it, which did not show 1.5% interest on them. Does not have any interest on them at all. No, sir, I would have put on evidence, which is my practice, and I would have caught it at that particular point. I know that, and I always include live testimony with each and every one of them that I do. I would not have had that problem. That is one place card that I do have. I have more now. Last but not least, the Killebrew case, which was cited by Tyra, specifically addressed the problem of a petition, a sworn petition. Although the prayer for 1.5% interest per month in the superseded pleading could have been offered as evidence of a demand of usury, it was not binding on the plaintiff as a formal judicial admission waiving evidence on the point. And cited an earlier appeal case in 1942 in which the writ was refused. And went on further to cite McCormick and Ray on evidence. Also, no findings of fact and conclusions of law were asked for in this case. I believe that the Seaman case, cited by the Texas Supreme Court in 1968, will apply when there is no findings of fact and conclusions of law. If you can find facts to substantiate the trial court, you heard all of the testimony, looked at all of the facts, had all of the people before them, then you must support their findings if there is a factual basis there to do it.
One of the things bothering some members of the court, and perhaps they're guilty of misconduct, all of us get bills from merchants. The first thing is a little form saying we would like you to sign the following that agrees to pay 1.5% per month if you'd like to have our charge account. I make it a practice to throw those in the waste basket. Then I get a bill and it has 1.5% on it. Whether, no matter what I do about it, I say, whoops, you didn't, I haven't signed anything like that. And I say, whoops, we didn't mean to send you that. Our computer made a mistake and we sent you the wrong bill. Is it the intention of the legislation to kind of discourage this sort of thing?
I would believe it is the intent of the legislature to prevent people from charging 1.5% interest per month unless they have a special kind of arrangement, which is regulated by anything, Regulation Z, to special extenuating circumstances. I believe that it's the intent. I don't believe that it's the intent of the legislature when an honest mistake is made, and there is no charge, no factual basis for it, top side or bottom, nor was there ever any charge to penalize someone for that. C.L. Tyler knew for a great period of time that he owed the money, didn't even answer any of the requests for admission, didn't even do that. He just knew that he owed the money outright. He had known he owed it for a long time. He'd had the man letters, only had the face value in it. Nobody was trying to stick in with any 1.5% interest. C.L. Tyler just came into a court and said, well, I think I've got a real sweet way to hide behind something, forfeit the debt, stick them with owing me twice the amount of interest that was erroneously put in, knowing that he no more owed that than a man in the moon. And I think that's the situation that's here today.
Suppose he had not answered and the default had been taken, and suppose not you, but somebody would have then proved up the invoices plus interest.
I believe that they would have charged usurious interest, didn't they? I mean, wait a minute, you say prove up
the invoices and take the judgment for the amount of the invoices plus the interest.
I believe at that time that they flat violated the statute. I think that time, whenever you take a judgment and you say, by golly, fellas, this is what you owe me, and I'm going to collect it right here through this judgment, I think at that particular point, you've gone way past catching it.
Well, then what we're saying is that a pleading is not a charge, a sworn pleading is not a charge, but if you take it to judgment, it's a charge.
Yes, sir, because that's supposed to be based on evidence at that particular time adduced before court.
Well, if he didn't answer, how's he gonna come in now claim usury? And you got the judgment.
I'm gonna have to try and collaterally attack it at that particular point.
Think you get anywhere with that?
Well, he may not win the case. That's not my point. I'm just trying to find out where the charge occurred in this factual situation.
In this factual situation, there is not a charge. I would be the first one to admit, had there been interrogatory sent out and had Bob Carroll Construction Company said, yes, we charge 1.5%, whenever you put evidence on, I believe at that particular point you're married to it.
But sworn pleadings don't count.
Sworn pleadings don't count if you catch your mistake and you make them aware of what happened. And then you put on the evidence to back that up and complete it.
And if nobody catches it, then it's not a mistake.
It would still be a mistake, and it would be a grievous error. It was a terrible error in this particular case, and this one is different than the average run of the mill. Nobody's trying to avoid a statute here.
Now, there's a difference between the charge and the demand.
Cases run every which way. I wish I had an answer for the court. There are some court of appeals that say that demand's a demand, which didn't say a whole lot to me. I went to John Carlton in Stephenville, Texas, and I sure do like to have things laid out for me. And I didn't completely understand that. There are some courts of appeals that say that a charge is some kind of a demand, and they leave demand kind of up to your imagination. I firmly believe C.L. Tyler didn't come into a court of equity with clean hands. He was hoping to hide, hoping to use a statute that he knew didn't apply to him.
Is that a defense?
The law's on your side. No, sir, I guess it's not a defense. You happen to know that this law's right with you.
I mean, you say that that's what you just said is a defense. We have a statute that says stop.
Yes, sir. And I am telling the court this is not a charge. That filing of that petition was not a charge, especially when the evidence was put on or some judgment was attempted to be taken. All the parties got to air it out before the court. They got to see all the facts and circumstances behind it. And that piece of paper was not a charge. Otherwise, how many claims could be avoided taking the flip side of the position that some of the members of the court are giving me? Could people just say, well, shoot, I just don't want to pay a debt that I know is just known, just because I know I'm a place to make.
Counselor, have you written a letter called a demand letter? That's the nomenclature used in trade. Necessary.
Specifically set forth what he owed, yes, sir.
You don't pay this. I say, had you written a demand letter to him, you owe $1,700 whatever dollar the account was, if that's not paid within 30 days, are you going to be liable for attorney's fees and interest at 1.5%? And would that have been enough?
That would have been good evidence to be able to use against me, I believe, and if it was coupled with the fact that it was put on the books or that it was the policy of that particular firm to use it and I was so instructed to do it. If I did it as an unauthorized act, and then we've got a principal and agent problem that is involved there.
Ask the question again, that'd be a charge.
If I specifically set it out, and then I go along, well, you're just saying on the letter alone, no further pleadings, no nothing from there on out.
You, as attorney at law,
that would be evidence that they could use against me.
Here's what you owe if you don't pay it, we'll take it to court.
If I didn't have any other evidence to be able to rebut that, I'd say yes, sir. Does the court have any further questions of me? If so, I'm not going to belabor it, but I'm more than willing to answer questions.
Rebuttal arguments and petitions?
Your Honor, the basic facts still exist that at the point in time that original petition was filed with the county court and then served on me, Mr. Tyra, there was a charge at that point in time.
Do you take a position, I guess I'll show off, that if the word not had been left out of some mistake in typing the petition, or not had been put in by mistake, and had been sworn to you, that bang, you're dead.
If it said, does not charge
if,
one.
It's typographical error.
That would change up the circumstances. I would think that it would be, I think that would fall under your, that's where your bona fide error part of the statute would come in. That's my argument in front of the Court of Appeals, in that I look at a bona fide error as being a typographical error. And when you hand
those, the secretary pulls out the wrong bit.
If
one has an instrument, one doesn't, throw that wrong bit.
Well, I think with all our new mechanical devices, it has complicated it some. But I guess in some instances, yes, that could be a typographical error that would be bona fide error. The one saving grace I feel on our side is that you have a sworn petition.
And it's sworn to it and not left.
Or solely on sun, but half of the cost of producing and lifting the oil is on the left arc. Now, I'll comment on that subsequently. That's fairly sun's language, as we'll see from examination of some of the extrinsic evidence later on. Mr. Foster had agreed to pay half the cost of maintenance of the well. Over in the middle of the paragraph, it says, set account to reflect and include production equipment and production or lifting expense in a manner customarily set up in oil field accounting and shall also include a charge of 6% to cover overhead expense.